commencing countdown.
3, 2, 1.
This is The Contracting Experience.
Connecting government contracting professionals to the world around them through conversations with acquisition influencers, insights into evolving hot topics, and sharing lessons learned from the field.
Welcome, podcast listeners. On this episode of The Contracting Experience, we sit down with Mr. Shane Bulware, a program manager for the AWACS E3 Modernization Branch at Hanscom Air Force Base. Prior to his transition to program management in 2020, Shane served on active duty for 8 years as a contracting officer in operational, systems, staff, and contingency positions. In addition to his full-time job as a program manager, Shane is also a reservist in contracting with the Defense Contract Management Agency in the National Capital Region. He is dual certified in contracting and program management as both a certified federal contract manager as well as a project management professional. Shane comes to us today to share how he unexpectedly had to widen his perspective to survive as a new program manager and how he realized there were things he wished he had known as a contracting officer. Welcome, Shane Bulware. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Rob, Justin. Appreciate you both.
All righty. Thanks, Shane. So, Shane, you have over 12 years in contracting, holding warrants in both the Army and the Air Force, and you now have 4 years under your belt as a program manager on a major weapon system. What are the major differences between those two roles, and what can you share as someone who has been successful in both?
I'd say the difference between contracting, which I'll call PK, and program management, which I'll call PM, is that PK is very regimented, rules-based. We've got the FAR we have to follow. And PMs are very polar opposite. I liken it to the Wild West, but it's not, chaos. It can sometimes be controlled chaos. But the vast majority of the PM regulations are much less specific than PK. So a number I like to throw often is in the PK world, we have the FAR, we have the DFARs and all the supplements and the PGIs and the manual procedures. At the Air Force level with us here in AFL-CMC, that totals to be about 4,500 pages of regulations, prescriptions, mandatory procedures, all the things that you shall do or shall not do. And those things change frequently. So about 2,000 pages at the FAR level, about another 2,000 at the DFARs and DFARs PGI level, and about 500 at FRs and FRs MP level, so totaling 4,500 pages-ish. However, on the PM side of the house, you have something far less specific. All in all, you have about 460 pages, and those are regulations, guidance, information. Most of it's tailorable, and it doesn't change nearly as often. So 4,500 pages on the PK side of the house, which changes frequently, and it's prescriptive. And then you have 460 pages on the other side of the PM house, which is more tailorable. Some of it doesn't apply to you if you're doing down different routes. And it's kind of like a choose your own adventure sort of style. And it doesn't change nearly as much. So when I think about what are the major differences between the roles, you have about 4,000 pages of differences between PK and PM. And that generates a lot of nuanced differences between the two career fields and what they are both there to accomplish. So I've been excited. I've been wanting to have this conversation for a while, ever since I transitioned to 2020. And I was within a year, it became so obvious to me that, oh my gosh, there are just things I wish I had known that weren't even on my radar as a mission-focused business leader in PK. It was astounding. And so I'm glad to be here answering these questions. Thank you.
Okay, awesome, Shane. What's an example of one of those things that was just, enlightening to you as a new PM that you wish you had known as a CO?
Ooh, I think the biggest thing is scope. Within PK, you are responsible for the Federal Acquisition Regulation and all of the things therein. So the Competition and Contracting Act, three pillars of fiscal law. Make sure you don't run afoul of bona fide needs rule or the Anti-Deficiency Act or the Misappropriations Act, and make sure you apply by small business thresholds and all of the FAR things in FAR Part 19. With NPM, it's that for 9 different career fields. So as a PM, you're responsible for about 8 to 10 career fields. You have to broaden your scope from just PK or PM or user to multiple career fields, each having their own interests, regulations, and who have to abide by their own regulations to fulfill their job. And as a PM, you are integrating all of them together to develop a capability to the warfighter. And one of those things you're integrating is PK, 1 of 9. Whereas PK, that is your role. You are to furnish a contract that is, you know, priced fair and reasonably, that abided by all the rules of that Congress and the FAR and the DFAR is laid out. So you go from handling one very, very specific branch on the tree to managing the tree. And you are one tree in a forest of other programs, each with having being their own tree, let's call that. So not only do I have to worry about all the branches on the tree integrating together to form a healthy tree, I also have to be cognizant of where my tree is in relation to all the other programs and their interests. Sometimes you come up with deals that help each other. Sometimes you compete for resources. You have to go in, out, up, down, around. Being a PM is controlled chaos, but it's so much fun.
No, that's great, Shane. Again, I love the analogy about the branches on the tree and the tree in itself, the tree in a forest. Great stuff. And again, I think that's something we might overlook on the program manager side. It's we expect them to know everything about the contracting world, but at the same time, they need to also be familiar with everything on the finance world, on the data integration world, and everything else. So yeah, great, mm-hmm. great analogy. Thanks for bringing that up.
Until you're given the kind of authority and the job to go integrate, it really doesn't, as a young lieutenant in contracting, it doesn't really cross my mind that that's what's happening in order for me to be doing what I'm doing in contracting. And I'm integrating FM and JA. It's kind of my little world as a contract specialist or as a PCO. And sometimes you liaise with the PM, but the PM is liaising with everyone else to include leadership to keep that program alive.
So how about this one? The PMCO relationship, right? That's really the heartbeat of the acquisition, right? When both functions are on the same page and working together, the program tends to take care of itself. When these functions, or dare I say, sometimes personalities are at odds, the entire team, as well as the program's success, gets put in jeopardy. What does success look like as a program manager versus, I hate the word versus, but as a program manager compared to a contracting officer?
Well, I love this question the most, I think. Success is the right way to look at it. Each person, whether you're logistics, finance, legal, test, schedule, cyber, configuration manager, engineer, you're each trying to bring what looks like success for your career field and your function to the table. And for program management, that success looks like delivering. I'll put a period right there, because if you want to simplify it, your job is to deliver, whether that be a product, a system, a good, a service. A PM is there to deliver. And then you get into the whole, what are you delivering and how are you delivering it? And that's the key tenets for a PM is the three pillars, not the three fiscal law pillars, but the three pillars: cost, schedule, and performance. That's what success looks like to a PM. Those are your guiding principles. And all those 400 pages that I mentioned earlier, which mostly say, figure it out. And most of those pages are like listing of responsibilities. Some of it says, do it within cost, do it under budget, and meet your performance parameters. That's your cost, schedule, and performance. If you follow those three as your guide, then you're very closely following the successful model of a PM. And we say cost, schedule, performance, pick two. Because if you want it fast and you want it done well, you're gonna pay a lot of money. If you want it done fast, but you don't want to spend much money, it's going to come at the cost of performance. That cost, schedule, performance, pick two, that is the dilemma of a program manager and considering all of the resources that I would have at my disposal, whether it be people, time, money, and then determining in what order I want them to be accomplished, because you can't always accomplish everything. It's just not enough time or money to do it all. So as a PM, what success looks like is your ability to manage those three considerations. That is the core reason why you exist, to manage cost, schedule, performance, and to integrate all efforts into delivering a product, system, service, what have you.
Okay, great. Great point, Shane. Again, love the analogies. Awesome stuff. I thought, one thing that came to mind is pick two, right? I've always heard writing. Write pretty fast, pick two of the three, right? Either write pretty or write fast. But if you're trying to do all three, sometimes that's a challenge.
Once you understand the role of the PM and what they're facing when you throw something over the fence, it really opened my aperture as to what it means to be a mission-focused business leader. I did not understand what that role really was until I became a PM. And I look back and be like, oh my gosh, I was an obstacle, not an enabler. I was too much of a stickler for the peculiarities of the FAR instead of applying the FAR to help my program manager whose job it is to deliver. I don't have the responsibility to deliver it. My PM does.
So moving on. So along those same lines as this PM-CEO relationship, right? Sometimes those relationships are great, and I just see the team having a lot of success. Other times I see the PM-PK relationship often just seems contentious from the start, and the program might suffer as a result. Do you have any good stories for either one of those scenarios?
Oh, I have plenty of stories, both as a contracting officer and as a program manager. And as a program manager, I live it every day. Each program manager brought their own spin on how they wanted to execute the rules of what's called the Adaptive Acquisition Framework, the AAF. Most of us, we grew up under the acquisition lifecycle chart, also called the horse blanket. So if you didn't know, that's been chopped up because it was deemed to be, when we started revamping everything into the modern age, digital transformation, digital material management, one team, one fight, all the accelerate change or lose action orders, they produced the Adaptive Acquisition Framework, otherwise known as the AAF, which is tailorable pathways that a program manager can take their program down. Each pathway has different authorities, efficiencies. It's kind of like the difference between going FAR Part 16.5 in IDIQ or FAR 15.3 source selection or FAR Part 13 simplified acquisition procedures. Same deal. You're choosing a different contracting pathway. So the analogy there would be in the adaptive acquisition pathway, there are six of them, and each one requires that you do something different to produce something for your program. Well, they can be very different from each other. And even within the same pathway, each program manager can implement it vastly differently. So when I was a PCO for different PMs in Hanscom, one PM was very, very new to the Air Force. And we might get into this later, how different the professional development is for program manager versus contracting. And it's one of the main reasons why you see contracting officers can walk into a room and have a pretty broad, diverse way of attacking things versus a PM who might have only been doing one program for the entire 4 years that they've been in their first assignment. So they've only seen one type of acquisition, that very specific one, whereas a contracting officer, by year four, by year six, you've worked dozens of contracts, most likely. You've worked dozens of contract actions. Each one pertaining to a different type of program, and each one spanning a different skill set that you've had to learn to churn out a contract or negotiate a contract mod that was fair, reasonable. I had a PM I need a decision because I need to negotiate a contract. We had the tech eval done, and when we got the tech eval back, we didn't have enough money to spend everything. And the tech eval team from the program manager side said, this is great. This is everything we want. Well, the proposal came in considerably higher than our IDCE, and so I had to negotiate down. But the program team didn't want me to negotiate down because they determined that all of those hours and met the objective, and not 1 hour would be less. So then you have a dilemma. We have to descope, or we have to find a way to come in under budget, because I can't, I can't be anti-deficient there, or I can't violate anti-deficiency. You do want to be anti-deficient, I guess, as my unlimited warrant board taught me. And as a PM, you don't know contracting rules. You don't know that this is really part of the deal. Sometimes when proposals come in too high, you have an affordability crisis. And sometimes programs get shut down because they are unaffordable.
Okay, so that was their take. They didn't want to dive into the proposal and see if there was excess.
Well, part of it was experience. They just didn't know that they could, and that they weren't facing Armageddon for their program. Because then when you start briefing that, I mean, those dollars can always be going to another program in need. If it becomes unaffordable, well, then you want to do that before you put it on contract. So what ended up happening was I had to explain to them, hey, this is contractor here, priced everything out according to the request for proposal that we gave them. This is the process by which we negotiate what is important, what is not, and probe them based on what it is that we think it should be at. Like, that's the whole point of negotiations. That's why I'm here to help you, PM. I'm here to help negotiate on behalf of the government. They just thought that there was no coming back from it. Like, oh my gosh, I'm going to have to report to my senior materiel leader that I'm way, way over budget. I'm like, no, that's not how this works, right? We send something over to them saying, this is what we want. They send it back saying, this is how much it's going to cost. We then go, do we agree with that? Do we not? Prepare our negotiation position. I then go get that cleared through my leadership to ensure that we're operating within the bounds of all due process within the FAR. And then I come back to you, and then we go to battle. And I say that, but we engage the contractor in a win-win discussion to acquire that win-win, where you're getting what you need and the contractor is able to live with the legal agreement that they signed. So once I explained to them how that process works, I think that really took a weight off of their shoulders, because the next thing they have to do is go brief sometimes an NHO4, sometimes a colonel or a GO, even sometimes, I don't know if you know Mr. Wirt as the SES for HB.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Mr. Wirt.
You know, sometimes you have to turn right around and brief Mr. Wirt if he has his attention on that for various reasons. So you have to explain as a PM what you're going to do about it, not all the excuses that you have for why it happened. And that's the standard you're held to. So it was just explain to them the process, explain to them how it is that we go about achieving our objectives and how those objectives do fit than the program manager's interests and responsibilities for delivering a capability to the warfighter. I know that was a long, drawn-out answer, but this is the sort of revelation that I'm seeing on my side. Is as a PCO, I didn't know what it was like being a PM, hearing that news. As a PK, I just can go to them and say, hey, we're over budget. What do you want to descope? Not realizing the profound significance of the PM's job to then take that and then work through 9 different career fields to come up with an effective solution that still meets the user's needs. And, right. And that can cause a lot of tension. Let's say that embodies the relationship between the two more so than I ever expected. Is when you go to a PM and say, hey, here it is, the PM doesn't just get to say, okay. They then have to do something about it to ensure that their cost is met, that their schedule is met, and their performance parameters are met. And if any of those things come into conflict that's unacceptable to them, they are compelled to engage you with this And that's what creates the tension and that tension.
Right. No, thanks, Shane, for that example there. Yeah. And I think it's spot on, really, right? Sometimes we focus very heavily on the business side of things, which is what we're paid for. And we don't appreciate sometimes the program management, that holistic view, if you will, of supporting the warfighter and the mission behind it. So, yeah, thanks for sharing that story. So let's shift gears a little bit. Still on the relationship, I've worked a lot of efforts from the contracting side where we didn't really have a, quote, program manager. Rather, it was more of an additional duty that a scientist or an engineer got handed. And quite frankly, they'd much rather be doing science or engineering type work instead of this program management additional duty. What advice would you maybe give our contracting teammates in that scenario? I'm definitely thinking the term mission-focused business leader comes to mind.
That's been something a part of my career since I started as a lieutenant in 2012. Mission-focused business leader, better buying power, money as a weapon system. All of these initiatives and frameworks that we operated under to grow as contracting people within the acquisition career field. And many times, especially on the con side of the house, my contracting squadron people, if you're hearing this, you do this as an additional duty without even realizing it most of the time, where a program manager is just an integrator of all the different career fields and interests and stakeholders within their program. They're a tiebreaker. When someone wants to put a dollar over here and you see that it actually needs to go over there, who's the chief decision maker that says, all right, this is what we're going to do? Most of the time, it's not PK. Most of the time, it's not EN. They all have their different focuses. A PM comes in to make that decision as the chief decision maker to properly balance cost, schedule, performance parameters. And without that role, you know, you wouldn't need a PM if all of the nine career fields, you know, your engineers, your finance, your logistics, contracting, your schedulers, your tests, your cyber, your configuration and data managers. You wouldn't need a PM as much as you do if all the career fields were working together seamlessly and out came a product. The PM's role would not be nearly as emphasized. But because each have their own interests, each have their own responsibilities and reasons for being, tensions, conflicts arise. And that creates a need for a tiebreaker, hence the PM. And as a PM, I call myself a teamwork enabler because I'm enabling, sometimes compelling, teamwork between different teammates on within a program or integrated product team or program management office, what have you. So if you're in a position where you are acting as a PM, almost like that tiebreaker. And as a contracting person, we are uniquely suited sometimes for that. It's one of the many reasons why the program management field loves prior contracting people. Because as part of our training, what's one of the main things you do within negotiations? You're trying to find that win-win between the overlap of what the contractor wants and what the government wants. You try and find that overlap in the middle, that win-win. Negotiations, alternate dispute resolution. The ADR, we, as part of our career field, is our training to manage conflict, to find that middle ground. So the example I gave with the lieutenant who didn't realize that it was part of the negotiation process to resolve those differences. Without that program manager there, who's there to resolve the difference? Well, the closest thing you have is a contracting person or an engineer. And so what advice do I have to someone in that scenario where there is no PM? Maybe the PM is away on leave, or maybe the PM role is vacant. Or if you're in contracting, sometimes a PM role doesn't even exist. You do exactly what you do when you're doing negotiations or any sort of alternative dispute resolution. You gather the interests of all the parties that are involved, and we call them internal and external stakeholders. So your internal stakeholders would be like the core program team. External stakeholders could be the contractor, sometimes even leadership, depending on how that leadership goes, or external sister agencies and that are involved in this. Like if you have a Navy sister unit that also uses your product. So you'd engage in ADR with the stakeholders, and then you would come up with what seems like the most common sense approach that you can build consensus on, and then that is what you negotiate to after you received your thumbs up from whatever PM leadership is present. There are some decisions which you might not feel comfortable making, and that's when you would leverage your leadership to help you engage their counterparts so that they can find you someone. The worst thing you want to do is make a decision in a vacuum. And I've learned that more than anything as being a PM, is I do not want to go make a decision that could impact 60 plus stakeholders without having some key stakeholders involvement and input to make a better decision. And if you're handed this job as an additional duty, whether it's implied or not, then you want to engage those around you. Find out who matters. That's the wrong way to say it. Find out who can approve or disapprove your actions. Find out who gives you your money. Find out who determines your schedule. Find out who gives you your requirement. Who's your user? It's one of the first things I do as a PM. I sit down and I break out my org chart. And in that org chart, I have a list of all my functions, the people who fulfill those functions, and what are they responsible for in delivering the program's goals. Do that yourself as a PK person, if you have to.
No, appreciate it. Yes. And again, I think you're absolutely right. And we often talk about the sides of the house, right? So the contracting side of the house or the PM side of the house. But I think the important thing to keep in mind is that we're all under that same house, right? We might have different experiences. We might be bringing, we have different reporting chains. We bring different perspectives, but we all want what's best for the success of the house, right? Or success of that program, or going back to your analogy, the success or the health of the tree. Right? All those branches working together. So let me ask you this one. Let's talk a little bit about your transition to program management. So what was the most difficult thing about your transition?
Oh, man. I'm glad you asked that question. A little bit of a rabbit hole, but very pertinent to the question you just asked. What is the most difficult thing about the transition from PK to PM or PM to PK is the polar opposite outlook that we and they have on what acquisitions is. Within PK, you follow the FAR. And the FAR, if you read FAR Part 1, it's quite black and white in saying that this is a tool you use to follow the rules and regulations, but this is a tool you use that you have to exercise good judgment on. For the most part, but as a young contract specialist growing up, you are following the rules. You are learning the rules so that you can follow them. When you become a PCO, you start to grow your wings a little bit to say, hey, this is how I apply the FAR in different situations. And then when you get to the point where you're an unlimited warrant or some sort of equivalent there, you are then walking into meetings as the sole contracting person in the room to then advise on effective acquisition strategy. When the PM says, hey, I have this problem, I don't know how to solve it. You're like, okay, here are the tools of the FAR that I can use to get you there. You grow from being in receive mode in the FAR to power projection of the FAR in meetings where people need advice on what lines not to cross. As a PM, you start out saying, here's a program, go figure it out. The transition is so different. PM is almost like the Wild West. You have to use your critical thinking skills from the outset because you only have 450 pages with which to inform you of how to do your job versus PK, you have 4,000 pages counting the FAR, DFARs, AFARs, as I mentioned earlier. 4,500 pages you have to learn. But in the PM world, when I got to in the PM job, and the first thing I asked was, what regulations am I following? And they're like, here you go. Here's DOD 5000. I'm like, okay, that's 20 pages. What else? Like, well, there's this other DOD thing. You read that. I'm like, all right, that's also 20 pages. What else? And then I became a program manager for an MTA, a mid-tier acquisition, which is kind of like a cross between a UCA, and it's basically given a lot of go-fast authorities. And so that go fast means go figure it out. Now that we've waived some of these requirements or consolidated paperwork into one decision document versus several. Now you need to go use that efficiency in your time and go figure it out. So being a PM and being a PK, if you're thinking the grass is greener on the other side, I want you to very carefully consider how vastly different these two career fields look at acquisitions. Going from PK to PM is like going from a very organized, structured, regimented process into a very wide open, flexible, ambiguous process. Going from PM to PK is going from a very wide open, flexible, ambiguous process into a very regimented, controlled, specific process. One is not the same as the other, and that's why they're so complementary, and that's why sometimes they're at odds, because sometimes there's tension between them. So the most difficult thing about that transition is adapting, conforming. Adapting to be a PM is like you suddenly have a day where you get to pick what it is that you want to go after. You get to pick what you don't spend time on. And it's not always obvious that you're making the right decision. Sometimes you have to make a decision based on that 80% solution or less because you don't have time to bring all the stakeholders together. Sometimes you're expected to make a decision 5 minutes after the decision is brought to you. Do you have enough time to do an IPT meeting with 9 career fields? No, most of the time you don't. Unless you're an HB and you've been implementing the digital transformation things that Mr. Wirt has us brief at the BRRR, the baseline execution review every year, where we're briefing to Mr. Wirt what we are doing to transform our program into the digital framework and apparatus that we need to bring about our capabilities in an efficient and timely manner. You are then responsible for figuring it out. There's no guidebook. There's no 4,000-page handbook on how to do your job. There's a 450-page thing that says, don't do anything illegal and more unethical. Here's what a program manager is. Here's what they do. Now go do it in relation to your program. Whereas PK, you have the FAR. You have requirements refinement. You have your solicitation building. You have your negotiations. You have your contract award, your post award, your administration, your surveillance, your payments. You just go on and on and on. There is a regulation for it somewhere in the FAR. It's not always the case, but 4,000 pages buys you a lot of answers. And that's why it takes, 6 years to grow a contracting officer, sometimes more. And so the difficult thing about that transition, I keep saying it over and over in a different way because of how surprising it was to me that day one of program management, you are told, hey, here's your program. Now go be a program manager. Sometimes that is literally what happens. And then you're like, okay, what do I do? What do I do about that? And the answer is go find your team and go find your stakeholder, go read your requirement, and then go do what needs to be done to execute on your milestones and deliver your program's capabilities. Whereas in contracting, if you're transitioning from PM to PK, you are told, hey, go do this requirement. It's going to be FAR Part 12. Here's the acquisition strategy in FAR Part 13. And we're not doing IDIQs in FAR Part 16 or source selection in FAR Part 15. We're going to utilize simplified acquisition procedures because it's under the threshold and blah, blah, blah. Now go, read FAR Part 12 and 13 and DFARs and AFARs. And then come back to me when you've delivered or you're ready to deliver on the solicitation, the request for proposal. Very, very different transition process. That's what I want you to consider, that it is lovely. I say this all the time. I miss contracting and I love being a PM. Each of them thrives in their own environment.
Yeah, I just wanted to say they each thrive in their own environment. Ideally, they're thriving in the same environment, right? Or at least towards the same goals.
Ideally, yes. I'd like to point out as well is something that surprised me was as a PM, and I mean this with all due respect, I love contracting. I am contracting. Contracting is a very small part of my day. If contracting goes down, everything comes to a halt. You cannot succeed without it. But it really only crops up during the requirements refinement phase or the solicitation phase or the award phase where you have to do a kickoff. Other than that, contracting is in the background doing all the contracting things, while I am my day-to-day meetings largely comprise of logistics, engineering, finance, all the problems that I have to solve, all the conflicts that have to be addressed. Contracting only pops up every now and again, unless you're pre-award, in which case it will take up a lot of time. But post-award, you're really only executing on the contract that the PCO signed. So it really doesn't pop up on my radar too much. But when it does pop up, it requires my attention. So that's a surprising thing I didn't expect, is that each career field has its own space that it exists within the program team. Contracting doesn't take up a lot of space. And when it does take up space, it becomes one of the top priorities I have to address in my day-to-day. But not as often as I thought it would when I first became a PM.
All right. Fair enough. Shane, Mr. Boulware, this has been very enlightening. On behalf of the Contracting Experience Podcast, all of our listeners and subscribers, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your insights into the world of program management and highlighting the importance that the different functionals each bring towards acquisition success. It's been a pleasure having you.
Pleasure's been mine. Thank you, Rob.
And thank you to all of our podcast listeners, followers, and subscribers. If you have any feedback, suggestions for topics, or future guests you would like to hear on the podcast, you can submit those via email to thecontractingexperience@gmail.com. As a reminder, you can subscribe to the Contracting Experience Podcast from any of your podcast listening platforms. Be sure to subscribe to receive updates and automatic downloads so you don't miss a single episode. I'm your host, Rob Lorton, from the AFMC Contracting Digital Division, and I hope you can join us again on our upcoming episodes. Until then, stay tuned and stay connected.